This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The 12-hour time difference between Washington and Beijing worked in favor of Hank Paulson today. It meant the Treasury Secretary could be on his way home from his trip to China before Congress woke up and got to work. That's important because today brought another congressional vote for sanctions against the Chinese. You know, trade war is a strong phrase, but it is what people are starting to say. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It's Wednesday, the 1st of August today. Good, as always, to have you with us. The list of things Congress isn't pleased with China about is pretty short. There's the trade gap and the Chinese currency. Treasury Secretary Paulson had been in China the past couple of days trying to deal with both of those issues. It's very much the old story of being between a rock and a hard place, trying to negotiate with Beijing and U.S. lawmakers at the same time. Congress is demanding Beijing let the yuan rise in value and so give American exporters a break. Before Paulson got on his plane home today, he admitted he didn't get very far with that. And not too much later back in Washington, Congress took China's currency into its own hands. Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports now from New York.
The Senate Banking Committee this morning passed a bill that would make it easier to slap the label currency manipulator on the Chinese government. Richard Shelby of Alabama is the top Republican senator on the panel. He says he co-wrote the bill and voted for it because he wants the administration to be more aggressive in punishing China or any other nation that undervalues its currency.
Congress has been reported to by the administration for a number of years. They say we didn't find any manipulation and we didn't do this. Well, it's hard for us to believe.
Every year, the Bush administration says China didn't mean to undervalue its currency. But the bill passed today says intent doesn't matter anymore. China can be called a currency manipulator anyway. The Bush administration hates this legislation and other China currency bills floating around Congress. Secretary Paulson wrote a letter to Congress yesterday warning that these bills could trigger retaliation and a global cycle of protectionist legislation. Trevor Hauser is an analyst with China Strategic Advisory. He says this banking bill that passed today probably wouldn't be as bad as the Bush administration fears, although it could call for taking China to the World Trade Organization, or WTO.
Basically, it just ratchets up the pressure on the Treasury Department. And it includes some instructions for the Treasury Department to pursue WTO action. But basically, the ball is still in the Treasury Department's court.
Hauser says China doesn't like to be told what to do by others. He expects China will eventually increase the value of its currency to combat inflation, all on its own. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Let's pause here for a brief mention of the stock market. Choppy, nervous, they would both be good words to use. Investors spent the day trying to figure out how they really feel about all the unease in the credit market. On the positive side, though, no mortgage lenders came out to say they were in trouble today. Oil traders had quite a day. They drove crude to an all-time intraday high of $78.77 a barrel. Then it promptly dropped a buck and a half by the close, which is kind of a perfect metaphor for the wild ride that oil has been on the past couple of months. 6 weeks ago, it touched the mid-60s. There are the usual suspects we could blame, refineries still recovering from Hurricane Katrina, rising demand, and speculators looking to make a buck. But that's all old news. We sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to find out what oil's got going on this week.
Why oil prices go up or down can often seem like a riddle wrapped in a mystery. Peter Butel heads up Cameron Hanover, an energy risk management firm. He says speculation is one culprit. But he says what's interesting about oil's high mark today is that the buying frenzy stopped short and prices dropped dramatically.
This market, at least its initial reaction, was no, we can't do it anymore.
In other words, the market seemed to bulk when prices neared $80 a barrel. Butel says big buyers like airlines can't afford to stockpile, and speculators may think the market's topping out.
If people tend to feel, well, this market just cannot do it, it just cannot rise higher, there's a good chance that we could see people that were buying start to sell.
There's also a chance they could place bets the other way and hold out for more money. Robert Bryce is with Energy Tribune.
The speculators are causing the price to go up, but the speculators are reacting to the apparent demand increases that show no sign of slackening, even at this higher price.
Bryce says skyrocketing demand from India and China could drive prices higher. And then there's the possibility of a political clash with Iran or a natural disaster that cuts into supply. Peter Butel says if oil prices do break that $80 barrier, all bets are off.
If we see that, there are going to be a lot of people who feel that we will see $95. And I've got objectives on my charts to $118.
Butel says our economy is already staggering under current prices. He thinks an additional $40 a barrel would be disastrous. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
We mentioned earlier this week the rebound one especially oil-sensitive industry seems to be having. Both Ford and General Motors reported better-than-expected profits. Of course, that was for the quarter ended June 30th. Detroit reported July sales today, and it is safe to say the bloom is off the rose. Ford sales tumbled 19%, GM off 18%. Even Toyota lost ground. Sales there down 7%. Airlines have been doing pretty well, but British Airways took quite a hit today. It's been fined more than $500 million for price fixing. Regulators on both sides of the pond levied the fines after a year-long investigation during which BA admitted colluding with a rival airline on how much extra to charge passengers to cover the rising cost of fuel. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
This is the biggest fine for a British company for breaking competition law. British Airways colluded with its old rival, Virgin Atlantic, on six occasions. The two carriers secretly agreed to increase their fuel surcharges by the same amount. BA's boss, Willie Walsh, wasn't running the airline at the time. Today, he denounced the price fixing.
Well, I condemn the actions of those very limited number of individuals who engaged in anti-competitive activities. It will not be tolerated. And I apologize for what this has done to British Airways.
The authorities are more concerned about what it did to passengers. Together, the two airlines hiked their fuel surcharges from $10 per round trip to $120, an increase of more than 1,000%. In Washington, Bill Mercer of the Department of Justice said this was not a victimless crime.
During this conspiracy, any person who flew on a British Airways flight between the UK and the US paid more for their airline tickets as a result of this illegal cartel.
An American lawyer is organizing a class action lawsuit for BA passengers. There could be criminal prosecutions too. Perhaps most galling for British Airways, its old rival Virgin has been given immunity because it reported the collusion. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Here's another word you could use to describe Wall Street today. Up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The American Secretary of the Treasury is not the only person who's ever gone to China and had things not quite work out for him. Hank Paulson is just the latest in a long line of Westerners who've run into trouble there. It's been happening for decades, not only to government officials, but businessmen, too, and journalists. Marketplace's Scott Tong is back home from Shanghai for a break. We thought we'd bring him in and talk about perceptions people might have versus his reality on the ground. Hiya, Scott.
Hey, Kai, how are you?
I'm all right. So, you know, 6 months ago, we sent you over to China, and we said, start yourself up what is basically a business, the Marketplace Bureau over there. It's an experience a lot of entrepreneurs have had, a lot of executives, a lot of businesses. Relate your experience to theirs for me and talk about some of the big surprises you think businesses face when they go over there.
Well, the first thing I thought when I went to China was Beijing is where the leaders are sitting there in the Batcave kind of running the country, and the whole country runs really efficiently because of that. Well, what I found out after covering just a few stories is the central government doesn't have the power that it needs. So many conversations end up in corruption at the local level is stopping the central government from doing the things they want to do. And they're trying to reshape this economy, move up the value chain, as the economists put it. But it's really hard when it's so decentralized and hard to control what happens in these far-flung provinces.
You know, when businesses go over there, they worry, obviously, about a lot of things. One of the big ones is getting fundamentally ripped off, that their intellectual property, whether it's, you know, a DVD or architectural designs, simply will just be taken from them. Do you find that to be the big issue?
That is a giant issue in China, whenever a company decides whether China is worth it for them. But one business organization has found that the bigger problem is HR issues.
Human resources.
Human resources. It's hard to think of China running out of workers, right? $1.3 billion, and they don't have enough workers. But so many multinationals are going into cities like Shanghai and Beijing, and they need experienced white-collar types with management skills. And the universities are cranking them out at a certain pace. But so many multinational companies are going there in a hurry and demanding them that they're all chasing after the same small group of people.
Let me bring this back to the headlines and talk about the thing that's been big in this country, the poison pet food, the poison toothpaste. Do you think the Chinese government realizes the looming catastrophe that it has on its hands if it doesn't quickly and to the satisfaction of the American consumer deal with these problems?
I think the government has an idea of what's at stake here. They know that the Made in China label is at stake here. What China is trying to do is to move up into more profitable sectors, and they can't do that if consumers worry about everything that's made in China. They know the Olympics are coming up next summer, and that is going to be the showcase. They want to show the world they can make auto parts, that they can make laptops, and all these great things that China is able to do. The problem is the public relations side of this. When the product safety story first came out, there were kind of denials, and a lot of this was perceived as a PR problem. And then over time, China started doing what a lot of PR professionals say was a good thing. They started saying, we have this problem, kind of moving in the right direction, having a lot of press conferences of how they were going to fix the problem. But there's a sense that there's not a broader infrastructure for that. You know, the leaders in Beijing are paying Western public relations firms to help them get their message out in Beijing. But in Washington, they pay pennies for lobbying and PR. So a lot of people say they need to spend a whole lot more money in Washington in order to get their message out the right way. And there's a lot of good news about China that isn't getting out.
Scott Tong runs our bureau over there in Shanghai. It's our own little marketplace business there. Scott, thanks a lot.
All right, Kai. Good to see you.
The mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, was in Washington today. There was a hearing in the House on health care in the wake of Hurricane Katrina almost 2 years ago now. Florida took a hit from that storm as well. By the time Katrina hit, Florida was in the middle of the most intense series of hurricanes ever, 8 of them in 15 months. And private insurers backed away from the Florida market. So the state created a government-backed insurance company of last resort called Citizens. From Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Florida once relied on companies such as Allstate and State Farm to cover hurricane risk. Citizens was there as a backstop. Then Hurricane Charley hit. And Francis, Ivan and Jean, Dennis, Katrina, Rita, and finally Wilma. Private insurers ran for the hills, and Citizens suddenly found itself with 1.3 million policies, one-third of the total. In other words, Florida's moving rapidly toward insuring itself. Scott Wallace is Citizens CEO.
I really don't think that the state of Florida had any other choice. Mother Nature created this situation, and we had to respond.
Meteorologists say we've entered a decades-long period of increased hurricane activity, and Florida, surrounded on three sides by warm water, is like a giant kick-me sign. Bruce Douglas is chairman of Citizens Board of Governors. He says if Citizens were a traditional insurance company, it would have increased premiums this year by a whopping 85%.
And the rate increases got to the point where somebody had to blow a whistle and say, the public can't handle this right now.
So earlier this year, the Florida legislature froze Citizens' premiums until 2009. Now the state-backed firm's adding 25,000 new policies a week. By year's end, nearly half of the state's homes will be covered by Citizens.
This is a great experiment in socialized property casualty insurance that we're seeing in Florida today.
Robert Hartwig, spokesman for the Insurance Information Institute, an industry trade group.
Florida overnight became one of the largest reinsurers in the world. And your average Florida homeowner is unaware that whether they like it or not, they are going to be obliged to pick up the financial pieces if and when a major storm occurs.
Since the legislature froze its premiums, Citizens may not be able to pay all the claims after a big one hits. So lawmakers have given the firm an extraordinary power, the ability to pay for a storm after it hits, through special assessments. If Citizens were to run out of money, every Floridian with property insurance would be forced to pitch in, possibly for decades. William Standers with the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. He says this may be the biggest roll of the dice in hurricane insurance history.
If you're not allowing private companies to charge what they need to charge, and you throw that policy of insurance to the state, you are just encouraging the dramatic expansion of your potential liability. And then ultimately the bill comes due, and we all pay.
But many homeowners said they were already paying out the nose through soaring premiums. They told their elected officials they would be priced out of their homes unless rates were slashed.
There are a number of Floridians that would have been homeless this year and I think would have been facing foreclosure and trying to refinance.
State Representative Jack Seiler helped write the new insurance legislation.
I think we averted a major disaster in the state of Florida.
Board Chairman Douglas says Citizens has $9 billion in hand, enough to cover all but the strongest storm.
It will take a Category 5 hitting the densest area that we insure. Then it's beyond any individual state's capacity to handle it. We'd have to reach out for help.
Floridians are hoping that help won't be necessary. But with August and September often the busiest months of the hurricane season, no one here is sleeping easy. In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Coming up, dark angles on Wall Street's white-collar crime.
You know, two investment bankers rigging a spreadsheet isn't quite the same as two grifters taking down a dog track.
But first, let's do the numbers. The stock market bounced and then settled finally in positive territory. The Dow Industrials rose 150 points today, 1.1%, ended 13,362. The Nasdaq ambled up 7 points, 0.3%, to finish at 2553. The S&P 500 gained 10.7%, wrapped up trading at 1465. Beazer Homes sawed off 18%. The company said there was no truth to some nasty bankruptcy rumors. Jones Apparel shed more than 12%. The maker of clothing and shoes reported a loss, cut its annual profit forecast too. MasterCard lost 6.7%. Its earnings fell short of expectations. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.78%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for June. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is scheduled to meet with Palestinian leaders in Ramallah before returning to Washington. And the House Budget Committee looks ahead to the long-term effects of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita on the federal budget. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Congress only has another couple of working days before Capitol Hill shuts down for its August recess on Friday, which, of course, means bills are flying out of there fast and furious. One of the big ones is a proposed $75 billion expansion of the State Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as SCHIP. It has a fair amount of bipartisan support, although the president's threatening a veto. He says SCHIP is too expensive and it extends government health coverage too far up into the middle class. Commentator David Frum says there's something else wrong with it, too.
Years ago, Donald Rumsfeld summarized his observations of Washington life as Rumsfeld's rules. Among them, if you can't solve a problem, make it bigger. Now Democrats are following in Rumsfeld's footsteps. They can't fix Medicaid, so they're going to make it bigger. After President Clinton's health care proposals collapsed in 1994, advocates of a federal national health insurance program decided to move more cautiously. Instead of erecting a single-payer system all at once, they would advance step by step. Thus was born SCHIP, the State Children's Health Insurance Program. States got extra federal money to provide Medicaid coverage for lower-income children under 18. If anything, SCHIP is even more generous than Medicaid, covering people with incomes twice the poverty line and paying higher benefits than Medicaid itself. But from the start, there's something strange and covert about SCHIP. SCHIP targeted the most politically sympathetic population, not the neediest. Rather than extending insurance to the uninsured, it shifted insurance from the private to the public sector. Medicaid already covered one-third of under-18s. SCHIP boosted that share to one-half. Yet of the additional kids covered by SCHIP, three-quarters already had private insurance. Now, Democrats in Congress are proposing to expand the program vastly, again to a population already majority insured. SCHIP was not created to solve a health problem. SCHIP was created to solve a political problem. How to sell universal government health insurance to a skeptical country. Advocates of national health insurance know what they want, and they have carefully considered how to get it. Those of us on the other side, on the side of private markets, have to meet and match them. If we continue to defend and excuse an increasingly unsatisfactory status quo, we are going to find that with S-chips, as with potato chips, people won't be satisfied with just one.
David Frum is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. You can tell us what you think online. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Fans of crime fiction are a special breed. Once they're hooked, and publishers know it. Akashic Books even has a noir series. There's Brooklyn Noir, San Francisco Noir, even, if you can believe it, Twin Cities Noir. So this next thing had to happen sometime. The series heads to Wall Street this summer. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now on the dark underbelly of the trading game.
The afternoon air wrapped around me like a hot, wet blanket when I caught the 4 train down to Wall Street. I found Peter Spiegelman waiting for me in one of those cute little outdoor cafes on Stone. Too cute, if you ask me. Okay, seriously. Spiegelman is the editor of the short story collection Wall Street Noir. He spent 20 years on Wall Street designing trading software for the likes of J.P. Morgan. He says the idea for the book took root the first time he set foot on a trading floor.
You know, two investment bankers rigging a spreadsheet isn't quite the same as two grifters taking down a dog track. But, you know, spending a little time on the trading floor, you see big egos and a lot of sweaty paranoia and a lot of money at stake and a lot of extreme behavior, and you realize it's very much the stuff and substance of noir.
A 14-year career on Wall Street wears away at your soul as assuredly as a stream against limestone. It pushes you to a place where you don't fully recognize who you are or how you got here. Wall Street eats its young. And today, the beast has a particular appetite for a certain 36-year-old maverick with 78 people reporting to him. That would be me.
As I read, I began to see what Spiegelman was talking about. Noir fiction celebrates the dark side of human nature. Protagonists are imperfect, heroes are scarce. Is that the Wall Street you know?
Virtue is not reliably rewarded or not rewarded at all, and if you happen to stumble upon the truth, it very often makes things worse. You've got characters who are in the grips of their own worst impulses, who are acting against their own best interests, who often know that they're doing those things and yet are compelled to do it anyway.
Take the day trader who finds himself stuffed in the trunk of a client's car after the market goes south.
I guess I was naive, but when I met him, he just seemed like a nice, hardworking Mexican man who was trying to make a better life for himself, just like everybody else who comes to this country. Later, I learned that he'd earned his money selling drugs. What can I tell you? I'm a moron.
Then there's the journalist who gets caught up in an insider trading scheme, hoping to impress an old college buddy, the subtly named Trip Pennypacker.
His sculptured hair was the color of champagne, and that amazing grin was, as ever, a treasury of enticing enamel.
If the writing can be a bit over the top, some of the stories ring a little too true, like Spiegelman's own tale of a derivatives trader who gets caught inflating profits at his investment bank. He flees to a small town in South Dakota, and without giving too much away, let's just say that even rural bartenders care about what happens on Wall Street, which brings us to another theme in the book. Wall Street no longer exists solely in Lower Manhattan or even New York City. These stories cover the map from Greenwich, Connecticut to Honduras, Israel, and Thailand. Wherever money and ego are on the line, bad things can happen. But Peter Spiegelman says it would be too easy to blame greed.
I think money in this case is sort of the most obvious symptom of something else. You know, it's not so much that they are interested in, you know, defrauding the firms of big money. But they are just terrified to somehow be revealed as failures or incompetent or, you know, somehow not up to snuff.
Spiegelman's not the only author with firsthand experience of how Wall Street can wear a man down. My favorite is the one by Henry Blodgett. The former star analyst at Merrill Lynch was charged with securities fraud. A number of emails made the case. He eventually settled with the SEC. Appropriately, his story Bonus Season features the dangers of email prominently. Blodgett writes with the empathy of one who's seen Wall Street's darker side and lived to tell about it. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, you might recall a month or so ago, the Vatican issued the Ten Commandments of Driving. Well, Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi knows a good thing when he sees it. Prodi wants the church to release a new set of edicts, these on money. Commandment number one, he says, thou shalt not steal from the state. Prodi says a third of Italians evade their taxes, and he would like the church to do something about that. His suggestion is more preaching from the pulpit about paying Caesar what is Caesar's. The Italian government estimates it loses more than $100 billion a year in unpaid taxes. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 150 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ gained 7 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 mopped up 10 points. That is 0.7% there. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba are our engineers. Next time on the program, a UK grocer answers the call of the hungry.
Almost irrespective of the type of household we went into, people were telling us what they wanted was fresh, wholesome food, but they wanted it to be affordable, and they wanted it to be available in their neighborhood.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.